When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carrillo.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
This is Yannick Noah, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
So Daniil Medvedev is an Australian Open finalist. He joins Novak Djokovic, who he'll face in Sunday's final, and of course Naomi Osaka and Jen Brady in that singles final lineup. You might notice I sound a little bit different to the usual very high audio quality you've come to be accustomed to, hopefully. And that is all because Billie Jean has chewed through a very, very, very fundamental cable to the recording process.
Why am I laughing? I mean, and this happened during the first version of this call,
yes.
And recording. So,
yep.
Yeah.
I was only saying 2 weeks ago that I'd never had to do a re-record in my 2 years on this podcast. Insert quote about London buses.
Yeah, she's really apologetic. She knows not what she has done, but she is very, very much in the doghouse. In an attempt to make up for this total debacle, I have captured some, depending on how you look at it, very funny photos of her with the incriminating cable. She chewed right the way through it. If it makes you feel any better, she really seemed to enjoy herself.
No, it doesn't make you feel any better. No.
Okay.
She can be Grigor Dimitrov smashing her racket into smithereens for all I care. But no, it doesn't.
At least
we've got Simon Briggs on the show today later on.
So Billie Jean's in the doghouse. Daniil Medvedev's in the final. What different fates they've both had today. Billie Jean is more in the Stefanos Tsitsipas sort of type situation. He came into a press conference in slightly existential crisis mode because 2 days ago he beat Rafael Nadal, and to use our, or perhaps David's, analogy, he thought he had conquered his Everest. And 48 hours later, he discovers that actually he's just got a new Everest. Because he's now actually got fewer wins over Daniil Medvedev than he does over Rafael Nadal.
Mm.
He's got a Medvedev problem.
He has, yeah. And wasn't Medvedev spectacularly good today? And he walked out onto the court. He was more or less booed onto the court by the Tsitsipas Greek supporting fans in the crowd. And, I mean, it was great fun, great pantomime, great sort of circus stuff, and Medvedev, you could almost tell that he was thinking, okay, this is my kind of thing, and he blooming well made it his kind of match.
Yeah, those are the conditions in which Medvedev absolutely thrives. Obviously, those were very much the situation he found himself in at the US Open a couple of years ago when he reached the final. Yeah, I mean, really stark today how much of a Medvedev problem Tsitsipas has. He's not the only one. Medvedev is beating everyone at the moment, quite literally. 20 wins in a row now, 12 of those against the top 10. but Tsitsipas wasn't able to read Medvedev's serve at all, and Medvedev really honed in on Tsitsipas's weaknesses, particularly that backhand, the way he exploited that backhand and extracted errors from it. It was a complete performance from Medvedev. I think one of the best I've seen him play. He actually said he thought he played better against Rublev the round earlier, when, you know, he was very good in that match as well. But this, to me, felt like a step up, especially considering we know the sort of weapons that Tsitsipas does have. Yeah, I thought he was absolutely brilliant today, Medvedev.
6-4, 6-2, 7-5. There was a tiny little wobble in the third set. He had led by a break. He squandered the break. Tsitsipas got it back. He said after the match that he got a little bit tight. He said the crowd got into his head in the third set, and he said that wouldn't usually be the case, but he was so unused to playing in that sort of situation with those kind of crowds that he very briefly let it get to him before swatting that to one side and being brilliant again. But there was just the faintest flicker of a moment where you thought a Krajinovic might happen. And Tsitsipas fans certainly did or hoped.
Yeah, and also that a Tsitsipas Nadal might happen, because he was taking that third set in a similar direction, making it close, clawing his way back, putting pressure on. And in the Nadal match, Nadal buckled, which seems so surprising, really, but that the two smashes and Medvedev did start to miss. He also started to play a little safer, because all the way through the first two sets, he was in charge. Tsitsipas could not hit through him. His ground strokes were making no impact at all. And also, Medvedev was just targeting the backhand relentlessly, almost like Nadal against Federer in the first 10 years, just saying, come on, keep swishing away with that shot and see if you can hit through me. Well, you can't, and eventually you're going to top edge one. And that was happening a lot. And he was going after his shots. And then just in that third set, when he was starting to tighten, he was playing safe. He was playing spinnier forehands that were sitting there for Tsitsipas to have a go at. But the moment he was able to just brush that off and hit through the ball again, those courts suit him down to the ground. The ball's skidding through low and just perfect for those flat drives.
Yeah, I think the feeling of the match in that third set changed more than the reality, because it really felt like a comeback was possible. And yet in the scoreline, Medvedev never went down a break or anything like that. He just lost the little lead that he had. So I think perhaps in our minds, it really felt like the match could turn there and then, but Medvedev never lost control enough so that it did get away from him. David said that Tsitsipas couldn't hit through Medvedev, and I was absolutely blown away to discover on the Australian Open website with their list of stats that Tsitsipas only managed to hit two winners from the baseline in this match, and both of those were passing shot winners. So whenever they were trading from the back of the court, Tsitsipas didn't once hit a winner past Medvedev. Medvedev has got this backboard capability that is so reliable and so dependable, combined with underrated movement, that he becomes completely impenetrable. And that's for someone like Tsitsipas, who has weapons. Now, he found some ways round it a little bit. Tsitsipas, he came to the net, knocked off some decent volleys, hit some winners from inside the court. But when they were going toe-to-toe from the baseline, there was quite literally no way through for Tsitsipas. That is how well Medvedev played today.
And through gritted teeth, Tsitsipas acknowledged that and more in his press conference afterwards. His teeth didn't look gritted. I'm just imposing that on him because I know these two don't like one another. There's no love lost. But actually, Tsitsipas was very generous about Medvedev in post-match press. He said, I wouldn't be surprised to see Daniil win the tournament. But then 2 years ago, I was 100% sure that Nadal was going to win the tournament after he beat me. I'm not a betting website. Don't ask me. Then he said, he's a player who's unlocked pretty much everything in the game. He's reading the game really well. He has this amazing serve, which I would describe as close to John Isner's serve. And then he has this amazing baseline game. So even if you return the serve, it's just so hard. He plays the game really smart. It's interesting to see that. I mean, he's right about all of that, as perhaps not the slight exaggeration about John Isner. But it is funny the way he thinks, well, if they've beaten me in straight sets, they're obviously the best player on the planet and they're going to win everything now. It is quite funny the way he does that. And he's kind of acknowledging that he did that because he did it 2 years ago. But yeah, it's hard to see the weakness in the Medvedev game. And he is this master of disguise. It's extraordinary. He's this supreme athlete in the body of a sort of slightly sickly aging man. He's got this sort of really quite effective forehand in the guise of this horrible, unwieldy, funky looking stroke. And he's got this backhand, which you don't know which way it's going until after he's hit it, almost till after the ball's landed in court. You just don't know what he's going to do with it. He's really something, Medvedev. And he's also this sort of lovely chap disguised as a pantomime villain.
Or he's a real villain disguised as a lovely chap.
Maybe.
Because, I mean, look, he's coming out into the court and there's a steel to him. I mean, he loved it when it all started kicking off and when Tsitsipas slammed his water bottle into the ground and Medvedev could just look at Riley, at the umpire, James Kyotovong, and just query as to whether that's a warning or whether it should be.
You gonna warn him for that? You gonna do anything? It was great.
Yeah, the aggro was simmering all match, wasn't it? It never quite boiled over, but it was always surface level. There was a moment where Medvedev ran past Tsitsipas's chair doing sort of high knees or something. Or
and Medvedev alerted James Kyotovong to the fact that Apostolos Tsitsipas was maybe being a bit too vocal. But beyond that, nobody was asked to shut their fuck up, and that was a tremendous disappointment.
Yeah, it was kind of what I expected, though. They have slightly rowed back from the drama that they had in their first meeting in more recent times. But I think that point about Medvedev's deception is so important because, I mean, personally for me, I find myself liking Medvedev more and more every time I watch him play. And usually one of the considerations for me that goes into why I like watching a player is because I like their style. There's something aesthetically pleasing about the way they play. That is a factor for me in which players I'm drawn to. And yet I wouldn't call Medvedev aesthetically pleasing, really, for my eye anyway. And yet I absolutely love watching him play because of that deception, because of how mysterious his game is. And the more you watch him, the more you understand him. And I think he's very rewarding from that perspective. Just a lot to get your teeth into with him. After you initially watch him, you might not think there is. But I think the more you watch him, the more you discover about him. And I think that's quite exciting.
Well, he also hit one of, well, probably the shot of the championship as well, which was just in the nick of time when Tsitsipas was coming back at him, forcing break points, and then suddenly plays a perfectly good point of serve out wide, forehand into the open space and actually into the corner. And he went from one side of not just the court, but the entire playing area, including the outskirts and outside the tram lines, went from on the right hand of the pitcher over to the left hand of the pitcher. And by the time he got to the ball was virtually on the ground. And he is with two hands and racket outstretched, flicking the ball around an incoming Stefanos Tsitsipas, curling it almost like a footballer hitting with the outside of the foot and bending it around the wall and into the corner. And it was just extraordinary. And his celebration afterwards, he loved it more than anybody in the whole crowd. And he was on his feet, waving his arms around like a football fan celebrating a goal. It was just amazing.
Matt, you posted a picture of the shape that Medvedev had to contort his body into in order to hit that shot. And it's ludicrous. It's not a human. It is like a contortionist in the sort of 1800 circus.
Yeah, and it shouldn't be possible to get your body in that position. And even once you've got your body in that position, you would think it was a really weak and flimsy position to be in. And yet he appeared to find stability and power from it. Just another way in which he's deceiving. He looks like his body should sort of break apart, and yet it doesn't. And it really rewards the tennis that he plays. He's absolutely fascinating.
Mats Wilander thinks that is the best backhand down the line. He says in general, the Medvedev backhand down the line is as good as anyone I've ever seen. He's seen a lot of people.
Rich praise. Well, it's fantastic, that backhand. It's so reliable for him. Plus, it's aggressive. Horrible combination for a player, especially if it's a right-handed player who's used to hitting cross-court with their own backhand. I mean, you don't want to be going there. And yet the forehand is increasingly becoming a problem as well. So he's an all-round... I mean, the only weakness he has is when he has to come forward to the net and he really looks unsure at the net. But so often he's won the point before he has to worry about that.
I think he's one of those players who's okay at the net on their own terms. He does occasionally use it as a tactic. He comes forward, but if you can drag him into the net, he looks really uncomfortable. And there were a couple of really, really dodgy volleys today, weren't there? They barely even made the net, and he was at the net. He sort of hit the frame with them. So that is certainly an area for him to improve. But as you said, normally it's not that much of a factor.
20-odd aces.
Yeah, and a 208-kilometre-per-hour serve, second serve on match point. That was lovely.
Says it all. And that's, you know, there are other players that do that, but they don't tend to be the very top players. Usually that's Nick Kyrgios, Mark Philippoussis, players that are a bit different, you know, actually increasingly, and it's not quite up there in the same velocity, but Djokovic has started throwing in a few of those. Not quite flat hit first serves, but really going after a second serve and accepting that it might miss. And I'm sure Goran has been an influence in that way, but it's definitely made Djokovic more effective. But the way Medvedev does it, it's just, I don't care. I'm just going to smash this down as hard as I can.
Just to touch quickly on Tsitsipas's performance today, personally, I felt like I'd probably overlooked how much the Nadal match took out of him. I really just assumed that physically he would be okay today, and perhaps he was. Perhaps it was a mental and emotional fatigue, you know, the fact that beating Nadal required so much of him and he was perhaps not quite able to bring his full tank to the court today against Medvedev. He seemed pretty flat to me.
This is probably the point at which usually, David, I would mock you for your prediction. But given I'm making you record this for the second time today, and you've just done two very ostentatious yawns, I'm going to let you off the hook and say whatever you like. Great predictions all tournament. Well done.
Thanks very much. I tried to hold him in.
He was a bit flat, wasn't he? I don't know whether he was necessarily physically tired, but...
I think the fatigue comes out when things start going wrong. Because I think he came out jauntily. I think he came out confidently. I think he thought, right, I've beaten Nadal. Come on then, I'll have the next one. And he just got smacked in the mouth. He wasn't expecting... he wasn't expecting Daniil Medvedev to just cause him that many problems, you know. And I think he's probably a player who quite quickly forgets the bad experiences and just assumes that this time it's going to be different. And he was shaken to the boots because, I mean, those two first sets were not close.
And expended energy he couldn't afford to on the crowd situation, on what the crowd were requiring from him. I mean, it doesn't suit him.
He was an inferior player with the crowd there, and I think mainly because he was having to get he was getting emotional, he was getting upset. I mean, fatigue can also bring on that and take you away from your calm that he'd established against Nadal. But I also just think, yeah, I do. I think that the heat inside the stadium, people willing him on, loving him, he likes it at arm's length. He kind of wants to just be able to go about his business, really. Yeah, I don't think it really did suit him.
Whereas it suited Medvedev kind of down to the ground. I'm fascinated to know what the crowd response is going to be on Sunday. David, would you like your spirits lifted by one Simon Briggs?
Oh, yes, please.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Well, here he is. It's Simon Briggs, everyone, the Telegraph's tennis correspondent. Simon, how you doing? How has your Australian Open been?
Yeah, been pretty bizarre. I guess it's a little bit like being in New York when you wake up and the office have already been awake for hours and you're catching up. Only this time you're waking up and the players have been awake for hours. It's quite discombobulating. But, I think that the tournament's definitely produced some decent stories, particularly second week. First week was a little bit squashed from a newspaper man's point of view because there were Six Nations rugby and England cricket going on. That was hard to get your voice heard above that, but it's a lot better this week.
A Djokovic Medvedev final is what we've just been working up to previewing. How much cut through would you expect that to have in the UK? How much space do you expect to get in the paper? How big a deal do you think that story, however it might pan out, will end up being?
Well, I suppose on the principle that, newspapers run on unexpected events, then a Djokovic win would be substantially less saleable than a Medvedev one. I mean, it's not as if Medvedev has a massive profile in the UK yet, but nevertheless, surprises are what tend to kind of motivate sports desks. And, the sad truth of yesterday's semi-final was that the desk were much more interested in Williams is going out than Azarka's going through. That's the way it works. So if Novak wins, then it'll be another record-breaking performance, as it is, when Rafa wins in Paris. And I guess I did the story at the beginning of the tournament trying to draw the comparisons between those two sort of absolute reigns. But it's not as if it's a dramatic result, is it?
Do you think he could, Medvedev, have a big profile in the UK? I mean, obviously, winning will be required for that. But provided the winning, whether it be on Sunday or at some stage, happens, we've just all been talking about how much we love him. All, his non-celebration celebrations, his not being afraid of a bit of aggro, his being the most gif-able man in tennis. Do you think he has the potential on the profile front to become someone with cut through?
Well, UK-wise, I would say that at the moment, the decisive factor is always performances at Wimbledon. So even if he was to dominate the hard court scene for years in a Naomi Osaka sort of way, until he wins Wimbledon, there's an element of people that he won't reach here. And I think you probably see that with Osaka as well, because she hasn't really performed that well yet on grass. There's a sort of a kind of constituency she hasn't really reached. In terms of personality, it's certainly he's a great interviewee, isn't he? And that's helpful. I would say that at the moment his game is sort of it may not be the kind that sort of people, it's a purist game, isn't it? I think I enjoy watching him, but I'm not sure it's the kind of game which will get the floating voter in the same extent that maybe Tsitsipas would if he was a stronger rival from Medvedev.
When you say he's a great interviewee, Simon, what do you mean? When he's in a press conference for you, what are you getting?
he just seems to really engage with the whole process. I mean, Tsitsipas does too, but from his kind of slightly kind of surreal sort of standpoint on life, Tsitsipas is very different, isn't he? Medvedev is more of a kind of, he's got a cheeky side, hasn't he? A mischievous side. He likes to kind of go at things from a slightly different angle as well, in a very different style to Tsitsipas, but it's just that sense that he's taking everything with the intent to give you something to work with. Let's put it like that, because today, you know, he's come out and he said that all the pressure's on Novak. I mean, it's not a complicated thing to say, but, you know, that's really helpful if you're trying to write a preview, if people are prepared to come out and say that. And actually, it's surprising how many people would just shy away from any sort of pre-match kind of mini baiting, you might call it, that he's doing there. And it's really refreshing if you're somebody who's used to people just telling each other how good they are and how much they respect each other.
Do you buy that? He said it both on the court to Jim Courier and reiterated it in his press conference. He said he's the 8-time champion. He's the one that's never lost a final. He said he's got all the experience, but he's also got all the pressure. Is that mind games, or do you buy that he believes that?
In a way, it's almost a declaration of how much he backs himself, isn't it? That he's prepared to go in kind of throwing a few darts in Novak's direction, because most people would kind of go in this situation saying, well, he's the 8-time champion, you know, I'll do my best and see what happens. I think it was more of a declaration of somebody who's so confident after, was it 11 wins over the top 10 players in a row? Is it 11 or 12 now?
12
Maybe
now,
it's 12.
Yeah.
I think it's 12. So I think he's just saying, you know, check me out. which is exactly what you want to hear from somebody in that position.
Did you see that Novak Djokovic on Eurosport said to Mats Wilander, he sort of gave you another good line, Simon. He's embracing this rivalry. And he said, we can talk all we want about the new generation coming through, but with all my respect, they still have a lot of work to do. And I'm not going to hand it to them, and I'm going to make them work their arse off for it.
Yeah.
A-dash-dash-dash, as it has to be in the Telegraph. I think that was actually recorded after the Karatsev win, wasn't it? So it wasn't in response to Medvedev's comments. But again, I think they're both sort of posturing a little bit, and Novak was really, really keen in every quote that he gave after his Karatsev win to tell everybody how brilliant he was feeling and to try and extinguish any hope that they might have that he was slightly wounded still. And that was, again, part of the same thing. So it was a good quote. I didn't actually end up really writing about Karatsev matches. It sort of lacked a bit of bite, really. But I kind of did a little bit of a resuscitation of the old Tsitsipas Medvedev feud, which, as far as I could tell, wasn't particularly reflected in any events on the court. But I thought it deserved another go. I hadn't written it for 2 years since the ATP Finals meeting.
My view is that we'll always, always deserve another go.
Yeah. Simon.
Is your current hairstyle a Tsitsipas tribute?
Just lockdown hair. I mean, I could have gone, I suppose, in that period when the hairdressers were open. But as we stand, it's now at least a year since I've been to the barber.
And it's had no attention.
Hairdressers were open for a while.
I know. Yeah. No, I just I didn't quite make it in that window.
Just embracing your inner Tsitsipas.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure I'm carrying it off, but...
I understand that some of your many thousands of words written already this morning are about Naomi Osaka and an interview you've done with her fitness trainer. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that was actually before the tournament, but I mean, I think the stuff about how they work together and how impressed that he's been with her is sort of evergreen. I mean, every trainer will talk up their player, obviously. You wouldn't expect them to do anything else, but he was interesting. You know, the guy worked with Sharapova for 8 years. And he thought when he finished with Sharapova that he really had enough of the tour, but I think, you know, he's a Japanese guy who spent most of his time in the US. So I think when the offer to work with Osaka came up, he probably saw something special there. And he talks about her being on a different level even to Sharapova. He says that, you know, her appetite for work and the intensity that she can train at is above and beyond. And I mean, I think that Sharapova, she'd never leave any, you know, I or T, undotted R uncrossed in her training. But I don't think that she was a natural athlete, was she, in the same way that Osaka is. And I think both Nakamura and Fissette have worked on her explosivity, and that's been a factor in the return games, because we're seeing the way that she's moving to the serve, and the match against Serena, four breaks in nine Williams service games. It's all coming out of the effort that they put in the gym, I think, partly, as well as just specifically training that aspect of her game.
I know you've resigned from tennis podcast predictions.
there's only two choices left. It gets a bit easier, right?
But I wanted to, one of our year-long predictions categories was whether Serena Williams will win a slam this year. I want to put that specific prediction to you. And I also want to ask your interpretation of her exit from the Rod Laver Arena yesterday and that very poignant moment where she greeted the crowd in the way she did.
Yeah, I felt it was a farewell, but I could be wrong. I mean, the other little wrinkle here is, I mean, you probably spotted the Courier interview where he asked her about the documentary crew that's been following her around Melbourne. I mean, somebody tweeted there were seven documentary crews present for last year's Australian Open. So I guess it's not unusual. And also Novak's having one film, isn't he? But nevertheless, there was a rumour that it might be doing a season's diary. And to me, that does have a slight whiff of a... is it a farewell diary as well? You know, and I just... with the Olympics coming up, it's such a big part of her career. I can't really see her coming back in a year's time unless something changes. I mean, maybe if she were to go on a winning streak again, I mean, I guess the next question is, will she win a major this year? And it can always happen. I mean, her movement was so good, wasn't it? So much improved in this tournament. And Wimbledon, everyone knows, has got to be her best chance. Osaka has never been competitive, really, on clay or grass. Osaka, I'm pretty sure, really likes playing her, even though there's this thing about her having, you know, Serena as an idol. I think that she just fancies it now. And on a hard court, to me, those last 8 points were so indicative of somebody who, even though she maybe didn't play a great match by her own standards, I don't think it was a great match, was it? But she knew that she had that extra level just to go to when she needed it, and just put the pedal down when she had to. So Osaka is a threat for her on hard, won't be so much on clay or grass. So I certainly wouldn't rule her out Wimbledon. But the other slams may be looking harder.
What's she like, Osaka, for you as a journalist?
Yeah, really good, because so different. I mean, we had this thing at the Telegraph where we did a supplement with her, the Telegraph Women's Sport, put her on the cover just last month.
She was editing it, wasn't she?
Yeah, she was guest editing it, and she contributed an essay about why she felt that she wanted to use the US Open as a platform for activism. There's a really good quote, actually, in the Yutaka interview where he talked about the pandemic, and he said, if you have a path that you want to walk, you can do it. But if you're not certain and clear, you will struggle. That's how he feels about pandemic life in general. And he thinks that because she found that motivation and that mission at the US Open, that it really, that was a really important period for her. They were all living in a house together, her, Fissette and Nakamura. And so they really bonded, and they went back to LA after the tournament, and they were in a house again. Working and just only going out for essential shopping supplies, he said. So they brought quite an incredible level of commitment to this business of kind of developing her athleticism and her explosive power. And it just sounds like they've bonded very well as a team. And Fissette, of course, such an incredible record that he's got with so many different players. You just think that they're on the right track.
I wanted to get your view, Simon, on a story that I think dropped yesterday, or certainly has sort of been around for 24 hours or so. I'm reading a piece in the West Australian about the cost of this Australian Open, the deficit that it will cost Tennis Australia, being estimated at $100 million. There are quotes from Craig Tiley here saying they don't know the absolute bottom line figure yet, but he said we're definitely going to lose multi-millions of dollars on this event. He says they have about 80 million in reserves, which they will exhaust. And then they'll be taking out anywhere from a $40 million to a $60 million loan. And he said, obviously, we took a big hit with 5 days with no fans. So you don't sell merchandise, sponsors don't get activation. You don't sell tickets or premium hospitality. So 5 or 14 days is a big hit. And he talked about their motive. You know, it doesn't sound like this level of loss has come as a surprise to Craig Tiley and Tennis Australia. So he's talked about what the motivation was to stage this thing. In spite of that, he said he feels like he's given the sporting world a playbook for staging events in a large international events in a pandemic, a playbook that they can share with the rest of the world. And he said that they feel like they've secured their future on the Grand Slam calendar, which indicates that they've perhaps felt like if they hadn't been able to stage it, that future might have been in question.
There was a lot of pre-publicity about that. I don't know if you remember people, including Daniel Andrews, I think, the Victorian Premier, saying, if we don't do it here, then they'll take the Australian Open and do it in Shanghai or Hong Kong or Singapore. And, you know, it did seem a little hysterical. In terms of the motivation to run, I think you've got to remember that if they don't run it, you know, they have at least $100 million of broadcasting contracts. So that money would have been forfeited instantly. So it seems to me that you were looking at a big loss not running a tournament, or a big loss putting it on. And I guess they would have hoped for it to be a little better, because they did lose that time in the middle. And overall, you know, the crowds have been small even when people have been allowed to travel. And it does feel... It's impossible. How can we tell from here? But it does feel as if the Melburnians are kind of brutalized by their lockdown experience. Excellent though they have been at containing the virus, and that people have just been they're just out of the habit of going to stuff, and that's hurt the tickets. Who would have guessed that that once they finally started the real tournament, the crowds would have been considerably smaller than the maximum attendance after people have been, you know, deprived of this sort of live sport for so long. I wouldn't have. So I imagine they would have had more optimistic forecasts. But to me, I think it was a lose-lose situation financially. And, you know, the real question is almost, how did he find that courage to run the event, knowing that, let's say, something had got into the community? I mean, to me, that, can you imagine how the damage that would have done to the Australian Open brand? So, yes, they're going to be financially crippled, but they have got away with it in the sense that the worst case scenario has not come to pass. And, you know, kudos for them for the efforts they put in, because it has been an absolutely mammoth undertaking. And, you know, I'm happy that we should be able to go away and say it was another good slam in suboptimal circumstances, as indeed were the two at the end of last year.
And incredible that they've maintained prize money. I know they've altered the distribution to make it more equitable, but given those numbers, incredible that they didn't choose to adjust prize money.
Yep. And, you know, when those players are constantly carping about the slams, not looking after them, I mean, it's different from individual tournament to individual tournament, but I think Australian Open has they've put their shoulders to the wheel for the players, and they deserve to be thanked by fans, players, you know, us in the media for the efforts they've put on.
Have you got any sense, Simon, of what's next for tennis. I feel like everyone's attention for so long has been on this Australia swing and getting the Australian Open done. I know there's been some quotes in the press conferences this week, Djokovic and Zverev talking about how they think tennis needs to adopt a bubble approach. Nadal kind of swatted that one away and said, well, where else are we going to have to quarantine? And Schwartzman, I know, has been talking about how difficult it is for people in South America if they're not going to adjust the rankings like they did last year so that you don't have to play. He said it's just going to be so difficult to keep travelling at the moment. What's your sense on all that?
Well, I mean, Monte Carlo is sort of the next, and Miami, I guess, are the next ones we're hearing of. Indian Wells is pretty much off, isn't it? Miami looks to be happening probably with a very limited sort of crowds and media attendance. Monte Carlo closed doors. So these are the sort of bigger events. It's going to be a mixture of cancellations and crowd-free events. In terms of the suggestion that people want the tour to stop, well, I'm not sure that the majority would go along with that, even though Novak did use the word majority in the press conference. There will be some who will say that that's a view coming from the sort of PTPA hardcore that he's kind of close to, because it's like the Australian Open. It wasn't perfect, was it? But it was the best that could be delivered in the circumstances. And once people start going to Europe, the majority of players will be able to get waivers in the same way that Andy Murray did when he went to play the Challenger in Northern Italy, so he didn't have to do any quarantine. The South American situation does make it much more difficult. So then you get to the question of, do you carry on for the benefit of the majority, even though there's a disadvantage to people from a particular continent? And probably you have to. I mean, what's your alternative scenario? Suspending might be fairer, but it would also leave a lot of people without any income and a lot of tournaments potentially bankrupted.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose a twin tour, you suggested, I think, at the start of the pandemic that we could end up with a golf-style European and elsewhere tour, that this could be what causes that kind of splinter. But there's absolutely no chatter about that, is there? I'm just sort of thinking aloud. Nobody's speculating that might be a scenario.
I mean, the thing is, you know, that Zverev and Novak both sort of posited the NBA model of having an event and putting sort of 4 weeks of tournaments on there. And yeah, if you're starting with a blank slate, you can do that. But you're dealing not with a league as a single league in the NBA form, but so many localized independent businesses and promoters who have their own needs financially and their own budgets. So he's right, that would be the best solution, but it's just not something that can be assembled. And I guess my pandemic theory of localized tours it sort of falls on the same disadvantage, that it's just ripping everything up and placing a pandemic tour in its place. It sounds good, but logistically, it's just not very feasible.
Not sure anyone's going to want to join a tour called the Pandemic Tour.
Yeah. I got two more questions for you, Simon, quickly. One is, come on then, let's have your two winners of these two finals.
Well, I think I have to go with the ranking favourites and be boring and go for Novak and Naomi.
Okay, and what happened on Valentine's Day?
when I sent Andy Murray's agent, it was well, I don't even know if it was a Valentine's Day emoji. It was that one with a coffee cup, a biscuit, and a heart between them. Do you know that one? It comes up on WhatsApp. Have you seen it? It's a sticker. Oh wow! So it wasn't even an emoji.
Or even
an emoji. Well, people did tell me I was making it up, so obviously I have made it up because I got the wrong piece of terminology.
Well, I don't know. I know that stickers exist and they're sort of there. And I always look at them and think, who uses those?
Now I know. Accidental tweeters.
So, Simon, you sent one of those accidentally to
Matt Gentry, the at 77, who runs Andy Murray's affairs, in the process of a debate about, is he going to play the second challenger or
did he leave it to hang there in the chat like a bad smell, or did he follow up with a, oh sorry, I meant that for someone else, or what?
I pushed the wrong button, but I was too slow to delete it.
What was the reply?
Happy Valentine's Day to you.
What a romantic lovely moment. Episode.
Magnificent.
That is sensational, Simon. Thanks so much for your company and for your predictions. We've missed them.
Oh, well, they were very exciting, weren't they? I mean, how can anyone ever predict against Novak on Rod Laver Arena? But having said that, you know, I think Medvedev has a chance, but you wouldn't back him, would you? Well, would you only be backing him? Or is it too early for that?
I might, but I picked Medvedev pre-tournament and I might stick with it. But if you, the tournament's not gone well for me generally, Simon. So don't as Stefanos Tsitsipas might say, ask a gambling website.
David's got Brady, hasn't he?
No. I had to get into the semis and being beaten by Barty, so that didn't happen.
Okay. But anyway, pretty good.
Not too bad.
As Simon might say, check out his pieces in the Telegraph. They're great. That piece with Osaka's physical trainer will run. Well, it will be up today, Friday, and be in the paper tomorrow.
Yes, that's right. Yeah,
lovely stuff. So check him out. And Simon, thank you very much. Enjoy finals weekend.
Thank you. Cheers.
Well, Simon Briggs, there. That was fun, wasn't it? It's never not a roller coaster with Simon.
Indeed. And the hair, legendary.
The hair is quite something, isn't it?
Yeah.
It jumped back when he came on the Zoom. Physically jumped back.
Maybe Milos Raonic would be a better hair comparison. He really embraced lockdown.
That's really
lockdown
good,
curls, didn't he?
Yeah. Mm.
And Pierre-Hugues Herbert. Although Simon hasn't got a top knot yet.
Oh, crikey.
He's had a go with one of those. He? Yeah. Yeah. I think right. So. Maybe not.
But. Big if true. what do we think of what he had to say? Anything we want to pick up on in particular? It's interesting what he was saying about, I mean, I suppose it's not surprising, you know, the kind of cut through of these players. I mean, Osaka and Medvedev, slightly different cases. Osaka, we're talking about somebody who could, you know, to quote ourselves, separate herself from the rest of women's tennis. And yet her results at Wimbledon have been such that here, and this is very UK-centric of us, but there might not be the cut-through that potentially warrants. It's like, you know, Oasis not making it in America.
We do, I think, always have to be mindful that we are a tennis podcast and we are people who work in tennis full-time, and that doesn't necessarily translate to a general audience. We've seen that with people who've done really well at Wimbledon and not elsewhere over the years. But I also found it interesting that Medvedev would kind of be the bigger story for him, whereas I suppose I would have thought maybe closing the gap might have been in terms of the Grand Slam race. But I found that very interesting from a newspaper perspective. And then just as a final thought on a more tennis-y angle, the suggestion from Simon that he didn't think Osaka would necessarily be a threat on clay or grass. I'm just so interested to watch her play on those two surfaces now, given what she's been doing for the last year. I mean, we didn't see her at the French Open because she pulled out after winning the US Open. It's going to be just, I kind of feel like I will watch every single match she plays on clay and grass. No matter when it is, I will just be glued to it.
Well, she'll be on for the calendar slam, won't she? As everybody is after winning the Australian Open. But, you know, it's extra motivation if it were needed.
If she wins it.
If Jen
Brady tomorrow.
Jen Brady could be on for the calendar slam.
Correct.
And she looks like she has a game that could certainly adapt to clay, I'd have thought.
Tell that to Clara Towson, Matt.
Yeah. Some of us went hook, line, and sinker for that one. Thank you very much. Mm.
What I think about Osaka is my impression is that movement-wise, she prefers the clay, actually. It's the movement on the grass where she really struggles. Mm. But sort of stroke production-wise, I think her shots would have incredible impact on the grass, whereas perhaps that power she has is slightly negated on the clay. I'm sure she can hit through it, but I think more people can probably live with it on a slower clay. So it's sort of two different things that she has to deal with on those surfaces. It's not the same problem.
She'll crack them both.
She probably will.
She will. It's just a matter of time. It's so often the movement with grass, isn't it? You know, I remember Karolina Pliskova kind of reaching breaking point a couple of years ago when she had lost early at Wimbledon, as she invariably does, and just saying, I wish people had stop telling me that I should be good on grass because I've got a big serve and a hard hitting game. She said, I find grass the hardest because I just can't move on it. I just can't nail the movement. And I think maybe it wasn't her that said that. Maybe it was Conchita Martinez that said that about her. But certainly she said she finds grass the hardest. I remember seeing Tsitsipas at Queens a couple of years ago and thinking, oh, Tsitsipas would be great on grass. He's good up at the net, all court game. And he just looked so unsure of his footing.
Yeah.
And hearing, he didn't mention this specifically, but hearing Simon speak there about Wimbledon reminded me that Daniil Medvedev cites grass as his favourite surface.
Oh, wow. That's interesting.
Or he always used to. I mean, he's barely won matches on clay.
And that's a very interesting one, you know, how his ball just flies through this surface and puts Tsitsipas on the back foot. And you watch him on clay and you kind of wonder how he'll ever win a match.
Mm, he certainly wonders as well. There were some very amusing Daniil Medvedev quotes during the clay court season at the back end of last year. So what do we think's happening tomorrow then? I'm going to give us all an extra 24 hours to nail our colours to the mast on Medvedev Djokovic. What do we think's happening? Is anyone giving poor old Jem Brady a chance tomorrow? I'm looking at you, David.
Yeah, I'm giving her a chance.
So you're predicting a Jem Brady win then?
No.
Right. That's what I meant.
No, I'm not going to pick her to win. I think she'll either play really well and we'll have another classic and she'll just get edged out, or she may struggle and it might be a blowout.
I'm leaning on the side of Osaka in two reasonably comfortable sets because I think she's a better player, number one, and she'll be able to deal with the occasion, I think, better. I am concerned about Brady struggling a little bit, particularly at the start.
I'm concerned about her being able to feel her legs. That's, you know, fingers crossed, sensation has returned. That was what she said. For anyone that didn't hear the podcast yesterday after she won the semi-final, I can't feel my legs.
Yeah, I think I just think Brady will come out and fight. It's just, can she connect early enough to get some foothold in the match? It can go by so quickly. But then, you know, we have seen some finals where Osaka started slowly. Remember the one against Azarenka last year? She turned it around, but It's not inevitable, this match. But I on the balance of it all, I would definitely pick Osaka to win.
Sorry, Matt, I interrupted you earlier.
Did you?
I did.
I guess it's...
Were you about to break into song or... No.
No. Okay. I guess it's a different sort of pressure, is it, for Osaka compared to her other major finals, in that she's such a heavy favourite. I think, you know, you think she's played Serena, Kvitova and Azarenka. They were all quite a bit tighter, I would have said. I just have this belief in Osaka that she can kind of handle anything. So I'm not really that concerned about that for her. It's just something that I've noticed. The dynamic is a little bit different in this one.
Mm. Yeah, I'm feeling a 3-4 or a 4-3 type vibe. Don't think it'll be a collapse from Brady, but yeah, that's what I'm feeling. But again, I'd point you towards my predictions record for the tournament and quote Stefanos Tsitsipas and say, ask a gambling website. don't ask a gambling website. Just finally, a bit of boat news for everyone. I received an unsolicited text message from my dad at 11:05 a.m. this morning. Daniil is definitely on the boat! Exclamation mark.
Oh, and the reasoning is?
I said, please explain why, for podcast purposes. He says, he would be great company, colon. Very smart, no ego, intuitive, mischievous too, I suspect. He would never be dull, and I love his accent.
No ego is an interesting line.
Mm.
Not sure about that.
I think in a boat scenario, I think he would put his ego to one side.
Mm. I bet Sisyphus is on the boat.
Don't know how much he'd love being crew. I don't know how much he'd love the whole, you know, authoritarian structure of a boat's crew, having to take orders from my dad.
Mm. I didn't think, fun that really came into the boat equation.
I didn't either, Matt, but it turns out Daniil Medvedev brings out the old mischievous side in David Whittaker. I think my dad might have to be prepared to do a Gilles Savara picking up his bag and walking off type thing.
Yeah.
Which...
He's got a dinghy, has he?
Yes, I think all boats have to have dinghies, I think. I asked him about Tsitsipas and he said he'd really like, he wants to want him on the boat, but he unfortunately doesn't at the moment. Too much mood, he said.
That is well put.
You can't have the two, you can't have them both on there, can you? Because no, it could be everybody true. Overboard.
Although,
if you do that.
If mischief is your vibe, definitely get them both on the boat, shutting their fucks up. All over the Atlantic. Apologies to David Law's mum for the language, but really it's Medvedev and Tsitsipas that should be apologising.
Yeah, Catherine's just quoting them.
Just quoting.
You know, you got to take that one.
Yeah. Just to whiz you through other very notable results from day 12 at the Australian Open. Elise Mertens and Aryna Sabalenka have won the women's doubles title 6-2, 6-3 over Krejcikova and Siniakova. That's their second Grand Slam title and possibly their final Grand Slam title together. They're not going to be playing the Slams this year. They are still going to play some non-Slam events. I think they've signed up to play in Miami together. But basically... Sabalenka has explained, I made the decision to play less doubles just after Abu Dhabi this year to focus on her single. She said, Elise couldn't find someone else for the Australian Open. So, of course, I said I'll play with her. We spoke about this tournament and I couldn't leave her on her own. So that's very sweet. They're a formidable partnership. So I wonder if they will actually be able to stay away from one another.
Well, they get on really well.
They do.
They?
It was a lovely celebration. There's absolutely no animosity between them over that split at all. But I do like it when they split up and get back together.
Mm-hmm.
Rajiv Ram and Joe Salisbury beat Jamie Murray and Bruno Suarez in the battle of the half British men's doubles team, 6-4, 7-6. So Ram and Salisbury are now one match away from defending their maiden Grand Slam title that they won last year. They play Ivan Dodik, Filip Polišek in Sunday's final. And Sam Stosur and Matt Ebden, the wildcards, they're into the mixed doubles final. They beat Salisbury and Desiree Kravchik in a match tiebreak. And they play Krejcikova and Ram in tomorrow's final. So the Salisbury double is off, but the Ram double is on. There you go. A few other lines for you from elsewhere in the tennis world. Daria Kazatkina has won a title and a penguin. Can only speculate about which one of those items is more valuable to her, but it was a very cute penguin. She beat Marie Bouchkova in the final of the Phillip Island Trophy.
Correct.
Bouchkova having beaten Andreescu in the semi-finals. The Billie Jean King Cup, formerly the Fed Cup, has been postponed. It was supposed to take place in Budapest in April, We were just discussing yesterday, weren't we, that suddenly April doesn't feel that far away. And they've postponed that until a TBC later date in the calendar, which seems like a smart thing. And just fingers crossed that's able to happen. Because it's just terrible timing for them that this all came right as they were relaunching and renaming the thing. And it deserves a good go for its first run out in its new incarnation. And we've had an announcement from the Lawn Tennis Association that the British summer tournaments, including Queen's and Wimbledon, they will go ahead one way or another. There's cautious optimism, I think was the phrase used, about the possibility of some sort of crowds being in attendance. But either way, they're planning on them going ahead. Hooray.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Wimbledon had already said a while back that one way or another they were going ahead. The hope is across the board for some crowds, and they just won't know for a little while as to what degree, what level they can have in attendance. But yeah, Queens, Eastbourne, there are tournaments in Nottingham and Birmingham. Sadly, Surbiton isn't going to be able to take place this year, but several will. I hope, and I think we've just got to count blessings a little bit, really, to have tennis back after last year when it was all dashed, you know, and it was such a sad time. But cautious optimism, that's a good way of putting it, I think.
So that is your 12th daily tennis podcast, the Australian Open. We have two more to come. Crumble will be our mascot for both of them. Hello, Crumble. Crumble's entered the Instagram competition. Send us post your pictures of your animals watching tennis. Tag us. Use hashtag tennis podcast pets if you wish. We're posting them on our... I said I would post the best of them on our story. I've just posted all of them.
Because they're all great.
They're all great. And I'm going to struggle to pick a winner. But it will be a pleasant problem to have. My mascot is Zeus. We got the result, but not the score again, Zeus. We ride again tomorrow. Matt, yours is Scouse.
Yep, same problem for us.
And David, you got Rogue. Also entered.
Oh, Rogue. Yeah. Yeah, we had a bad day. I mean, I couldn't have actually got it any more wrong.
No.
I said five sets for Tsitsipas and it was three sets for Medvedev. But anyway, you know.
Anyway.
Still 2 days to go.
Chris Albert Lee is our executive producer. He's a top bloke. And our shout outs today are for
Claire Gitsham.
Oh, a bit like Gippsland. Gippsland, I mean, sorry.
That's a stretch, but we'll go with it.
Hello, right, Claire.
Thanks ever so much.
Eric Chew.
Ooh, hello, Eric.
Right, Eric.
Speaking of chewing, I've had a bit of a puppy incident.
Yeah. Between the Simon Briggs bit and this bit, Billie Jean has chewed through Catherine's phone cable. Not to worry.
Well, yes, to worry, in fact.
Yeah, but it's very funny, wasn't it, man?
Very funny.
Hello, Eric, anyway.
David and I were speculating about what had happened. I don't think either of us thought that Catherine would now have two phone cables.
If only either of them worked.
And final shout out is for Eli Cronenberg, who is...
Ooh,
oh, my word.
Hello.
What a name!
Eli is the teenage son of Jane, and Eli is in our predictions competition this year.
Ooh.
That is a stunning name.
Representing
really
the family.
That really is a great name.
Brilliant. Thanks so much.
We have a friend of the show with a son called Eli, so we're a big fan of that name. Thank you very much for your support, all of you. Shame that none of you have names featured in famous songs, but, you know, there's always tomorrow.
I'm saying nothing.
I can hear the sound of chewing from beneath the chair, so I'm going to wrap this show up quickly. We'll be back with our 13th or penultimate Australian Open Daily Tennis Podcast tomorrow. Thank you for listening. Tell your friends, leave us an iTunes review, enter our competition, sign up for the newsletter, hashtag Free Britney. Have I missed anything? No. Okay. We'll see you tomorrow. Bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.